You're listening to the EU China podcast powered by the EU China Hub, straight from Brussels, a show on which we interview important actors in the EU China relations and cover the top EU China news. Our mission is to help you to get a more nuanced picture of what is going on in the EU China relations. My name is Greg Stets, and I'm happy to have you with us. If you like our show, don't forget to subscribe and to tell your friends about us. Let's get started. Here comes the EU-China news brief for May 25th, 2020. In today's news we cover: Two Sessions 2020, China's Economic Way Forward. Two Sessions 2020, Breaking One Country, Two Systems and Changing Rhetoric on Taiwan. World Health Assembly, From China's Worst Nightmare to a Dream Come True. France and Germany propose a recovery fund for EU. China discovers new clusters of COVID-19 as Europe reopens. EU's neighbor rethinks its post-Brexit China policy. This recording is based on a news briefing prepared by Flavian Berniaga and Grzegorz Stets. Enjoy. Two Sessions 2020, China's Economic Way Forward. On May 21st and 22nd, the two sessions began with a delay of roughly 2 months due to the coronavirus. They will last 1 week. And let's start with some quick definitions. So the two sessions refers to the annual congregation in Beijing of two political entities, the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. Together, they are officially known as the Supreme Power Body in China, but their powers are limited and they represent mostly a venue for the CCP to explain its decisions and plans to the wider public. The National People's Congress is a sort of a rubber stamp parliament body made of 2,987 representatives elected by People's Congresses in the provinces. At the lowest administrative levels of county and township congresses, they are elected by Chinese citizens. At every level above that, each congress is elected by the congress below it. Theoretically, the NPC elects the president and the chair of the Central Military Commission. Both of those roles currently belong to Xi Jinping. And also the NPC must approve the nomination of the premier. In reality, these decisions are taken within the party, and the NPC simply enacts them. When it comes to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, CPPCC, this is the NPC's advisory body, meant to represent civil society and has 2,200 representatives. It is comprised of influential business people, United Front representatives, ethnic groups, and some prominent thinkers. It does not have decision-making powers and largely exists to give legislation a seemingly more pluralistic character. So now, after this quick recap, let's move to the economic issues. Amid the dire economic state left by the virus, the two sessions disclosed both economic data and expectations. Breaking with the tradition of past sessions, Premier Li Keqiang did not provide an annual economic growth target for 2020. For a planned economy that perpetually evaluates its officials based on their compliance with growth plans, this decision is huge. Albeit, in recent years, Beijing has also been looking at improving environmental policies and innovation capacity. Instead, Premier Li emphasized stability and the need to keep unemployment low. He also announced a $506 billion, so 3.6 trillion Chinese yuan, fiscal stimulus recovery plan. The fiscal deficit will rise from 2.8% of GDP last year to 3.6% GDP this year. This is a notable move, as it is the first time that the fiscal deficit will have gone over the 3% threshold. Moreover, 1 trillion Chinese yuan worth of treasury bonds will also be issued, but they will not be included in the budget of the deficit ratio. The local government's special bond quota has increased as well from 1.6 trillion Chinese yuan to 3.75 trillion Chinese yuan. Premier Li also announced that business tax cuts and fee reductions worth 500 billion yuan will be implemented, while expenditure on investment projects will rise by 22.4 billion Chinese yuan. Non-essential spending will be cut by 50% and payments to local authorities increased by 12.8%. Interestingly, the People's Liberation Army had hoped to obtain a bigger chunk of the budget, allowing it to match or exceed the 7.5% growth registered last year. The request was grounded in arguments that the PLA needs more resources to tackle threats at home and abroad, particularly given what's happening in South China Sea and the tensions in cross-strait relations. Ultimately, the PLA's budget was increased by 6.6%, which is still considerable given the overall cuts happening amid the pandemic. It is also good to put China's economic reaction in wider context. So compared to the financial meltdown of 2008, the biggest independent variable of China in 2020 is debt. The fiscal stimulus announced by Li fell short of expectations, mirroring worries of overspending and debt, and China's total budget deficit hovers around 8.3%, up from 5.6% in 2019. And Beijing's stimulus is only 1/6 of that of the United States stimulus package, which is worth $3 trillion US dollars, with US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushing for another $1 trillion US dollars of stimulus. It is also smaller than the stimulus package that China released during the 2008 crisis and which was worth 4 trillion Chinese yuan. Beijing has learned the lessons of 2008 when China incurred massive debt and wasteful spending. Nonetheless, another stimulus package is expected. It will likely come once clearer statistics about the virus impact on the economy are known. So, what are the takeaways here? Usually, the two sessions are important because they reveal the priorities and plans of the party state and convey targets in economic growth, unemployment, inflation, and fiscal deficits. But this year, the two sessions adopted a completely new mantra. The fact that the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference happened in person makes an important statement, intended to signal that this situation is under control. However, expectations of economic recovery continue to be blurry. The package announced is not enough to restart the economy, and China is still waiting to see how the pandemic unravels, not only domestically, but also in its core markets in Europe and North America. That is why Li Keqiang did not announce all the money in one shot. Once demand picks up, it will become clear how much stimulus the Chinese government needs to inject to help its economy. But there is also another takeaway here. This is a year of historical events in China's economy. In the first quarter of the year, the economy contracted for the first time since the Cultural Revolution, and now no GDP target has been announced. This is very significant. Announcement of the GDP target has always been the key point of the two sessions, and it has always constituted a benchmark for evaluation of the performance of Chinese officials. It has traditionally guided the actions of a large part of both the state apparatus and more than 90.5 million party members. Instead, Li Keqiang focused on stability, keeping people, especially college graduates and the ex-military, employed. Beijing well remembers the Tiananmen protests, which were sparked to a large extent by the economic situation and unemployment. So with the economy, and also as we will see in other respects, Beijing is trying to close ranks and fortify. At the same time, it is aware of the challenges of excessive spending and wants to achieve stability without increasing an unsustainable debt and prompting unreasonable spending by local governments. Two sessions 2020, breaking one country, two systems, and changing rhetoric on Taiwan. Exacerbated by the aforementioned economic troubles, the Chinese government has made moves with deep implications for Hong Kong and Taiwan. On May 22nd, the National People's Congress announced it will sideline Hong Kong's Legislative Council and will pass a national security law for Hong Kong. In its wording, the new law both punishes and seeks to prevent acts of, quote, treason, secession, sedition, subversion against the central people's government, or theft of state secrets, and to prohibit political organizations and bodies of the region from establishing ties with foreign political organizations or bodies. End of quote. This is a clear sign that Beijing has become fed up with anti-government protests in the past year. It is also a follow-up to the demand from 2003 for Hong Kong to establish a national security law according to Article 23 of Hong Kong's Basic Law, the de facto constitution of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region under the One Country, Two Systems arrangement. The Hong Kong government has not adopted the law due to recurring protests against it. The National People's Congress also stressed that the Hong Kong government must craft promotional and educational programs and submit regular reports to Beijing in case national security is threatened. Enforcement of the law is still undecided. Technically, central government authorities can set up intelligence agencies in Hong Kong, but local administration still has the constitutional power of enacting Article 23 of the Basic Law. Even so, the Hong Kong government cannot contradict the law made by the National People's Congress, and Carrie Lam, chief executive of Hong Kong, has already indicated that she will fully cooperate on the matter. The law will be voted by the National People's Congress plenary on May 28. In the meantime, Hong Kongers took to the streets to protest the law. The police brutally dispersed demonstrators with tear gas and a water cannon truck, mere days after officials in Beijing stated that the law will not impact local freedoms. Over 180 people have been reportedly arrested so far, but the situation keeps developing. Taking a look at the international reaction, news of Beijing's decision sent waves through the international community, issuing a wide array of responses. The EU took a mild approach, saying it is closely following developments related to the law and reiterated its commitment to the One Country, Two Systems principle. Nonetheless, it stopped short of explicitly criticizing the move by the National People's Congress or indicating what it would do if the principle is not upheld. So far, no comments have been made by Germany, France, or Italy. The United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia issued a joint statement by their foreign ministers urging China to uphold the Sino-British Declaration and the UN Covenant on Human Rights. Lord Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong, took a harsher and more direct stance, saying, quote, "Unless the Chinese Communist regime sees sense, this will be hugely damaging to Hong Kong's international reputation," end of quote, and will, quote, "underline something which more and more people understand, that Chinese communism is not to be trusted on anything," end of quote. Boris Johnson, in turn, is expected to announce that the United Kingdom is ready to welcome refugees from Hong Kong. In the US, two senators started drafting a bill with support on both sides of the aisle to sanction Chinese officials and entities linked to the new law. In a less clear message, US President Donald Trump only said, quote, "I don't know what is it about, because nobody knows it yet. If it happens, we'll address that issue very strongly," end of quote. The US State Department took a different approach, warning Beijing that Hong Kong's special status in US law was conditioned by its autonomy and respect for human rights. And looking on the moves across the board, as of May 23rd, a joint statement signed by 198 legislators from 23 countries indicated their support for Hong Kong and warned, quote, "If the international community cannot trust Beijing to keep its word when it comes to Hong Kong, people will be reluctant to take its word on other matters," end of quote. Among the 198 legislators, 70 are from the EU, with Slovakia clearly taking a leading position with 26 signatories. Moving on to Taiwan issues. Speaking on May 21st of reunification with Taiwan, Premier Li Keqiang did not include the word peaceful in his statement, a break from typical wording. However, even if Beijing may want to switch its policy, it is griddled by critical economic and geopolitical factors. In his State of the Nation report in front of the National People's Congress, Li Keqiang opposed separatist claims and said he will encourage Taiwanese people to oppose, quote, quote, Taiwan independence and promote China's reunification, end of quote. It was the first time since Xi Jinping has been in power that the phrase peaceful reunification was not employed. The shift comes after 4 years during which the People's Liberation Army has deployed its air force and navy to deliberately circumnavigate the island and breach its airspace. It also comes amidst current and retired voices within the PLA claiming the coronavirus crisis presents the perfect opportunity for military invasion of the island. Nonetheless, there is no across-the-board consensus in Chinese society on military invasion given the potential cost to human life and international relations, as well as the question of American defense of the island. Xi Jinping himself has preferred to maintain Hu Jintao's guidelines on peaceful reunification. According to the reporting, for Taiwan's officials, the absence of the word does not indicate any meaningful change in China's approach, but it is an expression of Beijing's dissatisfaction. Li's statement comes just a day after Tsai Ing-wen was inaugurated for a second presidential term. She is an anti-unificationist and rejects the mainland's proposal to adopt one country, two systems to Taiwan. Even so, Beijing will have to interact with Tsai's Taipei for the next 4 years. So let's move to the takeaways. First of all, altering national security legislation in Hong Kong has been a key goal of Beijing since 2003. The Hong Kong government perpetually found itself constrained by protests by the Hong Kong populace, which was intent on protecting the island's autonomy and had to shelve the bill indefinitely. Following the protests in 2019, sparked by the extradition bill, and following police brutality, the central government probably grew conscious that Carrie Lam would not be passing the legislation and moved to do the legwork itself. Of course, this poses question of contradiction of Hong Kong's basic law and the one country, two systems model, which was supposed to ensure Hong Kong's autonomy until 2047. But making this move allows Xi Jinping to play the role of a strongman, diverting attention from other challenging issues. China's economic situation was already challenging in some regards before the pandemic, leaving it up for debate whether the party state will be able to deliver one of its century goals, doubling the 2010 GDP per capita levels by the end of 2020. The virus put another, possibly final, nail in the coffin of this goal. On top of that comes criticism about the initial response to COVID-19 and mismanagement of Sino-American relations. So now, with the growth target scrapped and concerns about employment stability, the government is doubling down on a nationalistic agenda that echoes well with domestic audiences. Such messaging helps the party state to project power and stability in the eyes of its mainland population. Another worrisome takeaway is that the response from Europe has been soft so far. The External Action Service and the UK have reiterated support for the one country, two systems, but did not say what they will do if Beijing tramples on it. As we mentioned in previous takeaways, the European External Action Service's hands are tied because it needs to speak with the voice of all EU countries at once, meaning the lowest common denominator, that is often toothless. Even so, the overall weak reaction is worrisome. It poses yet another question of the extent to which the EU is able to protect values in relation to China. Maybe German presidency could consider shelving the Leipzig summit in response to Beijing's move on Hong Kong. But hard ramifications have yet to appear, and we are also closely following these developments. And moving on to the takeaway related to Taiwan, we wanted to bring to your attention very interesting points made in the foreign policy. Hal Brands, professor at Johns Hopkins University, and Jake Sullivan, former deputy assistant to President Obama and national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, put forward a two-path approach to China's objective of superpower status. The first one asserts China will seek to establish a strong presence in the Western Pacific, in the same way the United States did with the Americas back in 1823 with the Monroe Doctrine. This path is bad news for Taiwan, because it most likely implies military conquest and a Beijing in a position of unassailable strength to dictate the politics of East Asia and Southeast Asia. The second path focuses on maintaining relations with East Asia as they are, but investing in economic, technologic, diplomatic, and political influence as a means of increasing its status. This would allow it to shape economic rules and international institutions and adopt global technology standards to its capabilities. This second path does not involve a military clash with Taiwan, and it appears it is, for now, Beijing's preferred modus operandi. However, given how Beijing approached the one country, two systems model with Hong Kong, it is unlikely that Taiwan populace will be open to entering into such a relationship in any foreseeable future. World Health Assembly, from China's worst nightmare to a dream come true. Between the 18th and 19th of May, the World Health Assembly, the forum through which the World Health Organization is governed, gathered virtually for a key meeting amid the pandemic. Ahead of the meeting, it seemed that big clouds are gathering over Beijing. 120 countries backed a draft motion for an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus. The motion, drafted by the EU and Australia, called for an, quote, impartial, independent, and comprehensive evaluation of the WHO-coordinated international health response to COVID-19, end of quote. While the motion did not mention Wuhan as ground zero for the virus, it did call for collaboration with the World Organization for Animal Health to, quote, identify the zoonotic source of the virus and the route of introduction to the human population, end of quote. Nonetheless, this motion did not make it to the negotiation table. Instead, the EU tabled a new draft motion, which was rather diluted. The new motion does not call for investigation of the origins of the virus, but an independent and comprehensive evaluation on, quote, experience gained and lessons learned from the WHO-coordinated international health response to COVID-19, end of quote. The new motion was approved by 110 countries, including China, and was eventually adopted. Xi Jinping conditioned support for the investigation on the basis that it will happen only after the pandemic is under control. Another contentious topic before the World Health Assembly started was whether Taiwan would be granted the right to participate in the meeting as an observer. Taiwan's participation was seen as a nod to its efficient handling of the virus and likely also its active Taiwan Can Help campaign, despite its observer status having previously been suspended in 2016. At the time, President Tsai Ing-wen publicly contested whether Taiwan was part of China, prompting Beijing to push for limiting Taipei's diplomatic presence. Taiwan managed to garner the support of important players for its WHO case, among others the United States, Canada, Australia, Japan, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and New Zealand. Nonetheless, on May 18th, the same day as the World Health Assembly was bound to begin, Taiwanese Foreign Minister Joseph Wu announced Taiwan will postpone its bid for observer status. The decision was taken after, quote, allies and like-minded nations, end of quote, suggested that Taiwan put forward its bid after the resumed sessions in order to allow other countries to focus solely on countering the virus. Wu made it clear that once things go back to normal, Taiwan will pursue a, quote, full and open discussion, end of quote, on its bid to join the WHO. But these topics aside, the World Health Assembly was also a great opportunity to compare the stance of two world leaders, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, who have provided vastly contrasting approaches to the World Health Assembly. On May 18, Donald Trump wrote a strongly worded letter to WHO's Director General, Tedros Ghebreyesus, giving the WHO an ultimatum of 30 days to, quote, commit to major substantive improvements, end of quote, and threaten to permanently pull the US out of the organization. He accused WHO of issuing misleading claims about the coronavirus and for being a, quote, puppet of China, by downplaying the pandemic. At the same time, President Trump refused to address the World Health Assembly at all. In turn, President Xi Jinping was expected to face significant backlash over the virus outbreak and the international community's calls for an international investigation into the origins of the virus, which were meant to hold China accountable. That did not happen. Xi managed, in fact, to turn the World Health Assembly to China's advantage. The problematic issue of Taiwan's bid was postponed, at least for now. The final version of the motion related to potential investigation into the origins of the virus diffuses the calls to hold China accountable because an investigation will happen only after COVID-19 will be brought under control. In the absence of a vaccine, this may not happen in 2020 at all. She also pledged $2 billion in funding to the WHO over the next 2 years, which matches WHO's entire budget contributions in 2019. It is more than twice the US contribution in 2018 and 2019 combined, before Trump retraced it, and 4 times that of the UK in the same time period. By comparison, the European Commission's 2 years contribution for the 2018 and 2019 sessions was $131 million. She also pledged to aid healthcare systems of developing countries in Africa and offered a future Chinese-made vaccine as a global public good. What are the takeaways here? First of all, we're clearly observing a power vacuum that is being filled. Multilateral China and unilateral US is not a new dynamic, and the two are definitely interlinked. We've seen it already happening at the United Nations level, where Trump used the General Assembly of the United Nations platform to reject the Paris Climate Accord, quit talks on migration, walk away from the Iran deal, and withdraw from the United Nations Human Rights Council, all while China increased spending on peacekeeping missions and managed to have Chinese nationals lead 4 United Nations agencies. In a similar vein, Trump's decision on the WHO limits US power and participation in global responses and creates a vacuum that China is eager to fill because it helps both its domestic and foreign policy. The EU, once again, finds itself stuck between American unilateralism and a brand of Chinese multilateralism that it doesn't fully support. Lacking the American support, the EU probably saw itself cornered to accept the watered-down motion because no better option was available. Another takeaway here is that the problem with Donald Trump, aside from encouraging us to take hydroxychloroquine, is that he is terribly inconsistent. He is not wrong that there are massive transparency issues related to the virus's origin in China, but he is also covering up his failure to contain the virus by scapegoating the WHO. The WHO and its Director General can undergo several months of scrutiny for their dovish attitude on China, but in fact the WHO is not an executive organization. It relies on messages from its members, including China and the United States, and its job is mostly to coordinate and advise members. Trump himself praised China 15 times between January 22nd and February 29th while the virus was spreading. And moving to another takeaway and turning to China. China is by far the country most advantaged by how the World Health Assembly turned out. It managed to dodge 2 bullets, Taiwanese participation and independent investigation into the origins of COVID-19, while also branding itself as the friend of developing countries in their fight against the coronavirus. At the same time, China exhibited the extent to which it will punish those who question its narrative. On May 19th, it slapped an 80% tariff on Australian barley exports, which threatened to create a dent of $500 million a year in the Australian economy. This was in retaliation to Australia being the first and one of the most vocal countries to request an independent investigation into China in the context of COVID-19. France and Germany propose a recovery fund. On May 18th, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron held a joint press conference by video at which they announced their joint proposal for an EU economic recovery fund, signaling their support for a more robust EU response. The plan involves a temporary fund of 500 billion euros with money borrowed from financial markets, then distributed to member states through the EU budget. The expenditure ceiling of the EU budget would increase to 2%, up from 1% of gross national income for the next 3 years. The extra 1% would not be contributions from member states, but debt. Importantly, it would not be counted as individual debt of the member states, it would be the EU's debt. And Angela Merkel said the money would be distributed to, quote, the most affected sectors and regions on the basis of EU budget programs and in line with European priorities, end of quote. Competitiveness, digital and green transitions are key staples of the plan. The money would be paid back after the end of the next multi-annual financial framework, meaning after 2027. But some member states are not excited about the idea. The so-called Frugal Four, composed of Austria, Netherlands, Sweden and Denmark, rejected the proposal and came up with a loan-based alternative. This is important because any plan needs to have support from all member states in the Council to be adopted. The impromptu leader of the four, Austria, announced through Finance Minister Gernot Blümel that they cannot support a plan where, quote, the EU borrows on the markets to finance non-repayable grants, end of quote. Their core argument is that money borrowed from the markets should be paid by the countries who receive the cash, and it must be followed by deep reforms to make their economies shockproof. In turn, Southern Europe retorts that the crisis was not its fault, and that further adding to its already high levels of debt will slow down the EU's recovery. Nonetheless, the debate was notably less combative than before. Strong loan supporters such as Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte or Swedish Finance Minister Magdalena Andersson were not nearly as vocal as during the Corona bond saga. A number of Central and Eastern European countries also voiced mild concerns, fearing such a fund would cut financial streams that usually flowed into cohesion funds from which they benefited. The Frugal Four presented on May 23rd an alternative plan that approves of a one-off emergency fund but rejects debt mutualization or significant increases in the EU's upcoming multi-annual financial framework. But it seems that everyone agrees that whatever the solution, it should not come without strings attached. As one of EU diplomats put it, quote, if you're spending everybody's money, terms must apply, end of quote. Merkel and Macron included in their proposal a requirement of a, quote, clear commitment of member states to follow sound economic policies and an ambitious reform agenda, end of quote. Commission Vice President Valdis Dombrovskis explained what that meant. Most of the money would be spent on investments and structural reforms. Member states would need to agree on common recovery priorities, then present investment and reform proposals based on those priorities. The Commission would monitor their implementation. Nonetheless, the official blueprint to be issued by the Commission this week will provide clear details into the Commission's expectations and will decisively dictate the position of member states. Moving on to the takeaways. A month ago, we encouraged you to think of the implications of a fiscal union. Are we there? Not quite. This would not be the first time that the EU issues debt for balance of payment support, but it has never happened with such a big sum, so the agreement between Merkel and Macron is truly a big stepping stone towards further European integration. Within 5 days, Angela Merkel endorsed the joint recovery plan and showed support for a political union that, quote, may also involve amendments to the treaties, end of quote. Furthermore, during the first in-person meeting with her commissioners on May 18th, Ursula von der Leyen told them that the EU has an opportunity to lobby for new powers and place the Commission at the center of the recovery. This shows that there is impetus in Brussels, Paris, and Berlin for reform. The Commission's proposal for the recovery fund will most likely indicate whether the member states are on board to boost up the EU's competencies. Another takeaway is that even if the Frugal Four did put forward a new plan, a level of consensus seems to have been reached on linking loans to structural reforms. An official from Mark Rutte's party highlighted economic structural reform as a key point for the Netherlands. Polish Minister for European Affairs Konrad Szymański and Slovak Foreign Minister Ivan Korczok echoed similar sentiments. So even if Vienna and Amsterdam will finally budge on grants, they will come with serious economic reform proposals for Southern Europe. In our next takeaway, we also want to ask a question: what drove Germany to finally switching sides? Well, for once, we could thank Emmanuel Macron's efforts to stand with Italy, Spain, and Portugal, while also winning friends in Belgium, Luxembourg, and Ireland, thus creating a team that supersedes the North-South divide. Secondly, and probably more importantly, Karlsruhe did the trick. The German Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe cast doubt on May 5th on the European Central Bank's bond-buying powers. This proved to be the tipping point for Merkel, who came to the conclusion that the coronavirus presents the EU's biggest crisis yet, endangering its single market and the overall future of the Union. This is something from a leader who has dealt already with crises in 2008, 2012, 2015 and 2016. Strengthened by her currently unmatched popularity at home, she put Karlsruhe in its place and threw her backing behind the commission. China discovers new clusters of COVID-19 as Europe reopens. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen new developments regarding COVID-19 in China, and those should not go unnoticed in Europe. First, Chinese authorities moved to test the entire population of Wuhan, where the coronavirus originated. It is a huge undertaking considering that the population of the city amounts to 11 million people and the initial plan assumed finishing the testing in just 10 days, although this may be postponed. Excluding people who were tested in less than a week before the mass program began, the number totals at around 8 million people. The tests began on May 18th, with the Wuhan Health Commission reporting on May 20th that more than 2.8 million tests had already been completed. The rapid progress can be partially attributed to using a batch testing method, so grouping individual samples and only testing individuals if a batch comes in positive. The second important development is that new clusters were discovered in northeastern provinces in China in May. The clusters of the coronavirus were discovered in Jilin, Liaoning, and Heilongjiang, despite China applying one of the strictest virus prevention and detection regimes in the world. As of May 21st, Chinese authorities confirmed 46 cases located across three cities, Shulan, Jilin City, and Shenyang, all believed to be linked to travelers from Russia. Among the 46 reported cases, 10% turned critical and 26 were hospitalized. In response, the authorities reintroduced lockdown measures over a region of 100 million people, including halting train services, restricting entrance to residential compounds, and closing schools. It comes as yet another blow to the already economically challenged northeastern region, sometimes referred to as China's Rust Belt, as it is home to China's declining heavy industry. In 2019, the three aforementioned provinces jointly had a GDP standing at less than half of that of Guangdong province. But the worrying message here is that the cases from the new cluster appear to be different from the virus in Wuhan. The infected seem to carry the virus for longer and to show no symptoms for a period longer than 2 weeks. Moreover, the virus appears to damage primarily the lungs, which is different from the reports from Wuhan, which pointed at multi-organ damage. Still, it is hard to confirm at this stage if the virus has indeed mutated or whether the differences in observations are the result of doctors not operating under critical conditions, as were the doctors in Wuhan. If the virus mutates so quickly, it would make the efforts to research it and develop a vaccine much harder. And this comes amid global infection hitting new milestones. On May 20th, the WHO confirmed the highest single-day spike of new cases, totaling at 106,000 new cases in 24 hours. 2/3 of the cases were reported in just 4 countries, which also topped the number of cases in general: the US, Russia, Brazil, and the United Kingdom. The number of global cases surpassed 5 million just a day after the WHO's announcement. Meanwhile, in Europe, multiple European member states are moving to lift restrictions. Most of the member states moved to reopen bars, restaurants, and retail on May 18th, and mask wearing is not obligatory in many of these countries. Symbolically, one of the countries to reopen was Italy, the first country to go into full lockdown. Over the last 2 months, Italy lost close to 33,000 lives, and its economy shrank by 10%. Following the Commission's guidelines on tourism and transport in 2020 from May 13th, most member states plan to lift restrictions on non-essential travel around mid-June. So, what are the takeaways here? First of all, despite being busy reopening the economy, the EU should not overlook the new developments in China. And as we discussed in one of our past news briefs, the EU countries have already once disregarded the situation in China and even reported to the Commission that they were ready to tackle the threat of the virus, which turned out not to be the case. Now, armed with the traumatic experience of the first wave, they hopefully monitor the second wave in China, which follows the lifting of the local lockdowns. But at the same time, it's important to remain cautious when monitoring the situation in China. China most likely has been toying with its COVID-19 data in the past, as we explained in one of the past briefings. That means that the current reports should also be taken with a grain of salt. Beijing is concerned with its economy, and announcing alarming new data or deciding to put Wuhan under lockdown once again would undermine the belief of the markets that China is recovering and could also affect domestic spending. Both are now important for the Chinese economy, which is trying to regain strength and remain stable after the historically terrible first quarter of 2020. So there are definitely incentives for China to downplay the situation. EU's neighbor rethinks its post-Brexit China policy. The outbreak of COVID-19 hit the United Kingdom hard and made the Conservatives open a debate on a rethink of China policy. Here are a few examples. At the end of April, a group of Conservative MPs formed the China Research Group, modelled on the European Research Group formed in the context of Brexit. The goal of the new group is, quote, to promote debate and fresh thinking on China, end of quote. Also, at the request of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the authorities are developing the so-called Project Defend, which is aimed at identifying the UK's economic vulnerabilities and developing a plan to diversify supply chains of essential non-food products. It is to be part of a broader approach to national security developed by Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab. But the move that caused probably the most interest is the fact that on May 23rd, reports emerged that Johnson asked officials to draw up plans to phase out of the involvement of Huawei in UK's telecommunication infrastructure by 2023, reducing it to zero. And this announcement comes just a week before Prime Minister's visit to the United States for the G7 summit, when Johnson is expected to negotiate a trade deal with Donald Trump. And bear in mind that this comes at a time when Brexit negotiations are growing tenser. On top of this comes the matter of China not respecting the Sino-British Joint Declaration concerning Hong Kong and breaching Hong Kong's Basic Law, which we discussed in the second news bite. Still, it is unclear whether these moves are part of a mature long-term strategy on China within the Tory camp. So the takeaway here is that as much as it is unclear whether the United Kingdom's government has developed a concrete long-term strategy on China, it is clearly going to be part of wider thinking about the UK's position after Brexit. For a better context for such considerations, we encourage you to listen to our interview with John Farnell, a former European Commission director responsible for international affairs at DG Enterprise, currently DG Grow, and a research associate at the University of Oxford China Centre. We discussed with him the impact of Brexit on EU-China relations and the UK's position within the US-EU-China triangle after Brexit. You can find it on our website or on your podcast platform of choice. And that's it for this week's news brief. See you next time. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the EU-China podcast. If you want to know more or to get in touch with us, visit our website, which is euchinahub.com. And if you find this show insightful, be sure to leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It will help others to get to know about us. See you next time.